This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
On the program today, some high culture, the CEO of the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Also, banking, artificial intelligence, and Rube Goldberg. Not, I should say, all in the same story. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Wednesday, March the 9th. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Economists talk sometimes about the velocity of money. It's a tad esoteric, but basically, it's how fast a given dollar moves through the economy, how fast it's used to buy stuff. Takes a while, right, with actual physical cash, but in this digital age, why wait? Bank of America and U.S. Bancorp said today they are going to roll out a brand new service whereby one can, using an app or on a computer, send money to a friend or to pay a bill. Yeah, no, that's not the new part. What is new is the ability to do it instantly. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
So customers of Bank of America and U.S. Bancorp can, as of today, send money to each other electronically. PayPal was founded in 1998. Where have you been, banks? It's 2016.
Part of it is they're not quite sure how to make much money off of it.
Deborah Baxley is an international cards and mobile payments consultant. And in fairness to banks,
banks have been quite busy after the crisis, taking care of regulations and raising capital. And they had all kinds of other issues they were dealing with.
Rajesh Kandaswamy is with Gartner Research. So the banks are a little late to the mobile payment game. But they are also upping their game. Sending money between customers of Bank of America and U.S. Bancorp is instant. Luann Alexander is with Early Warning. They operate the payment system used by the banks.
It's within seconds that that money is available. You can take it out at the ATM. It's very immediate.
PayPal has some options for speedy payments, but it usually takes a few days to get your money into your bank account. The downside with Bank of America and U.S. Bancorp service is that it's only instant if you're sending to fellow Bank of America or U.S. Bancorp customers. That may change if other big banks join. J.P. Morgan Chase and Capital One say they will this year.
That could make it a pretty competitive offering and could certainly provide a lot of competition for PayPal.
Stephen Bigger is with Argus Research. Consumers might have another benefit by going through banks, says Early Warning's Alexander.
That safety and security of dealing with my trusted financial institution.
That, of course, depends on how you feel about your financial institution. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
All right, this being economics, it's worth a detour here into incentives and how they matter. Healthcare division. As it stands right now, doctors and hospitals get paid more if they prescribe more expensive drugs for their Medicare patients. Those are misaligned incentives, which has helped almost double Medicare Part B drug spending over the past decade to $18.5 billion with a B dollars. Yesterday, federal officials proposed a new rule that would realign those incentives by encouraging docs to prescribe more affordable but equally effective meds, which is where Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein picks up the story.
Right now, if an oncologist prescribes a Medicare patient a chemotherapy drug, he'll get reimbursed, plus a 6% markup.
So if there's a drug that costs $1,000, the doctor gets $60. If the same drug costs $100, the doctor would only get $6.
Amitabh Chandra is an economist at Harvard. Under the proposed rule, that same doctor would still get that reimbursement, a 2.5% markup, and a $17 flat fee. Chandra says the whole idea is to root out lousy financial incentives most of us don't see.
We as a society have a tendency to assume that high-cost drugs are exclusively the result of biopharma companies charging very high prices. What we fail to realize is that physicians and hospitals also have extremely strong financial incentives to push high-cost drugs.
The proposal has certainly aligned hospitals, doctors, and the pharmaceutical industry, all vowing to block the move.
This would dramatically decrease the reimbursement on these drugs. It's just not viable.
Ted Okon heads up the Community Oncology Alliance. This change, he warns, will force docs to sell their practices to hospitals where care is more expensive, hitting cancer patients hard. Expect some fierce fighting over the next 60 days until the public commenting period closes. University of Chicago economist Rena Conti says this intense pushback is the messy work of healthcare reform.
If we want to change the system to be more value-based, that means fundamentally disrupting the revenue models of a lot of really big players in healthcare.
That, she says, is daunting, but worth the struggle. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Might not feel like it given the volatility of 2016 so far, but the fact is the post-recession bull market turns 7 years old this very day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A 3,000-year-old Chinese board game has met 21st-century technology, and the technology has won, in a manner of speaking. An artificial intelligence program built by the AI company Google DeepMind has beaten the top human player of Go, the aforementioned board game. It is just the first game in a five-game series, so there's still time for humanity to come back, but the win is a big deal because Go is considered to be some orders of magnitude more complicated than chess. Our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, is here, as she always is, to make me smart. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So how did this thing do it? I mean, this is the best human player in the world that it beat.
Yeah, it's the best human player in the world at the hardest game
right,
in history.
Right.
And so that's the question. Yeah, you know, what's really interesting about this particular AI is that it can learn and it can approximate intuition, which is kind of the crazy part of this story, that it can recognize not only its own mistakes, but sort of make educated guesses at what will pay off in the future based on those past mistakes. So that's why it's such a huge achievement in terms of artificial intelligence, because it's doing the kind of pattern recognition that was previously reserved for, you know, humans.
Humans, right. Okay, I, for one, welcome my new robot overlords, but what happens next with this intelligence?
You say that now, Kai.
That's true. Easy for me to say now.
No, what's interesting is that we're in this era of big data, which we talk about all the time, but we're discovering that we actually have way more data than we can analyze, that we can do anything with. And so it's just sitting there. There's all of this promise of patterns that can save lives or make people tons of money or build brilliant robots. So far, we actually just don't have the computing power to sort that data and draw those conclusions. So AlphaGo and that whole DeepMind division are kind of a move in that direction. And of course, this is technology that's directly beneficial to Google, which is, of course, collecting tons of data and uses it to make money in all kinds of different ways.
Well, now that you brought it up, making money, right? The first thing I thought of when I read about this story was IBM and Watson and how everybody said, oh, my goodness, this is going to be great. How's Watson doing as a business operation?
Yeah, so that is the question. Watson is not doing that well. I mean, look, IBM has basically bet the farm on Watson as technology. They've been pouring money into it. They've been marketing it like crazy. People have said that they've now shoved so many business divisions under the Watson brand name that it's hard to tell what's even actually using that technology anymore.
Huh.
Most experts say it's still not even quite as smart in the real world as a toddler.
Wow.
And so it takes a long time for these technologies to pay off. Now, Google's in a slightly better position. It's not betting the entire company on the DeepMind division, so it probably has more time to nurture the tech into a bigger business.
Yeah.
But so far, at least Watson, as an example, is a little bit more marketing than it is payoff.
All right, so that toddler comment, and we just have a little bit of time left, guts my last question, which was, where are we on the scale of the Turing test, right, where humans have to guess whether a computer is actually a human or not?
Yeah, you know, there are various elements of that test. I was just at a conference where people were predicting that in terms of speech recognition, that a computer will be able to fool humans because the artificial intelligence that lets a computer talk back to you has gotten so good. I mean, we're getting closer, but you got to figure we're at least still 5 years away.
Hmm. Molly Wood on AlphaGo and DeepMind and artificial intelligence. Thanks, Molly.
My pleasure, Guy.
Today, from the Marketplace file of unlikely stories of international high finance, this item, a report from Reuters that Saudi Arabia is looking for a loan. Yes, that's Saudi Arabia, the one with all the oil. Seems the government in Riyadh has been running budget deficits and drawing down its savings and has gone to the debt markets looking for $6 to $8 billion American to tide it over. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more on that one.
Why in the world is Saudi Arabia having to borrow money when just one of its princes is worth $20 billion? David Andrew Weinberg, a Middle East expert at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, says it's trying to make up for falling oil prices.
The Saudi economy is overwhelmingly dependent on oil income for paying basic budgetary needs.
And even not so basic, like creating government jobs to keep people working and happy and not revolting. Robert Manning is with the Atlantic Council.
They've been used to using the oil money to provide a welfare state.
Like subsidizing the cost of gas and water and not charging income tax.
They don't want to cut expenses because they're afraid it'll jeopardize political stability in the kingdom.
Saudi Arabia is also fighting battles in Yemen, pledging troops to Syria, and that all costs money. But since it's anyone's guess when oil prices might rebound, David Andrew Weinberg says there's now a question as to whether the Saudis can get back to the boom times of oil prices past.
There is a fear that the economic model in Saudi Arabia and several other Gulf monarchies may not be sustainable for the long term.
The Saudis have hundreds of billions of dollars in reserves, so for now, there's no cause for panic, says Vali Nasser, a Middle East scholar at Johns Hopkins. But if oil prices are still low, say 5 years from now?
There's going to be a big structural gap, and that can no longer be glossed over with short-term borrowing.
And yes, at that point, Nasser says, it just might be time to panic. In Chicago, I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Coming up.
When you walk in this hall, one cannot help but to think creatively.
The Walt Disney Concert Hall, that is. A chat with the woman running the Los Angeles Philharmonic. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 0.2%. Today, 36 points on the blue chips, closed at 17,000 on the nose. The NASDAQ advanced 0.5%, 25 points, 46.74. The S&P 500 also tipped up 0.5%, about 10 points, 1989. The cloud was all silver lining for Box. Shares in the data storage company were up around 4% today in anticipation of a solid earnings report. Turns out mission accomplished. Shares climbed 16% after the bell, and the report Square, the mobile payments firm started by Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey, reported its first round of earnings as a publicly traded company. Stock added just under 5% before the announcement and another couple of percent after it was delivered. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.82%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You've heard, of course, of Rube Goldberg, the devices, if not the actual man. He was a cartoonist. The devices are legend. The classic example is the self-operating napkin. You raise a spoon to your lips, 13 Byzantine steps later, a pendulum with a napkin attached wipes off your chin. It is, generally speaking, a complicated machine to perform a simple task. Not perhaps the best model on which to build a thriving business, but there is a guy here in Los Angeles making some real money courtesy of Rube Goldberg. Marketplace's Andy Euler went out to his studio to look around.
Brett Dorr is standing next to something I've never seen before. It's like a wooden catapult with some weightlifting plates on one end. It's a medieval siege engine called a trebuchet, a counterweight catapult from the 12th century.
I've been testing it because I don't want to use like an actual projectile, but I've been testing it just with this little bag full of rags.
Okay, 3, 2, 1.
That bag of rags makes it over the wall about 10 feet away. Dorr says he built this trebuchet because he likes to fling things around with it. But something similar has also been featured in a machine he built for Google. In fact, Dorr builds a lot of stuff for tech companies. Right now, he's working on a machine that crushes cans with a sledgehammer.
What I have here is
there's a gear motor down here, and so this drives this chain. When this post rotates around, it actually lifts this lever and lifts the sledgehammer.
Dorr says he's always been good at building this kind of stuff. He studied to be an architect in college, and he was a teacher for a little while. He also spent a year on a fishing boat in Alaska.
You know, at the same time, I was building stuff like this and doing all this stuff. And I had all these careers, but they were all sort of about subsidizing this stuff.
His website claims that he can build anything out of paper clips.
For a long time, I was building a lot of stuff out of paper clips and bottle caps and tin cans and stuff. And I really found that nourishing because those are stupid materials to use. When I failed, it wasn't sort of like, oh, because you're stupid. It's because, well, I'm trying to make this thing out of paper clips.
What turned this into a business was a call from a pop band, OK Go, about 5 years ago. Dorr helped build a machine featured in the song This Too Shall Pass. The machine starts when a toy truck is pushed into a line of dominoes. It ends with a yoga ball rolling down a ramp, triggering paint guns to fire at the band. The song is almost 4 minutes long, so you can imagine the scale. The video's been seen a bunch, more than 50 million views on YouTube, but the machine only ran once. To run it again, you'd have to rebuild it, and some argue doing that would tarnish the experience. Bill Welter founded Clarity Creative Group.
The juxtaposition of that extremely analog kind of contraption invention that Brett builds, contrasted with the invisible software and the invisible technology that changes all of our lives on an everyday basis, is of great interest to a lot of audiences.
But these live events are still a one-time deal. Dorr's done work for Google and Intel. They've got a lot of cash, but they're still businesses. So how can they rationalize dropping six figures on something so impermanent?
One of the things that makes an experience special for most of us is the fact that it's hard to replicate. And you have something special if you were there at that point in time when it happened.
Dorr's schedule's pretty full. He's even busy enough building these things to get some other people into the studio to help out. That's something he's really proud of.
What's happening now is that, like, I've actually can... you know, hire people, and, you know, I'm a job creator.
Next up, Dorr's busy building stuff for TV shows and movies. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Okay, so first of all, you should watch that OK Go video. It's pretty cool. Second of all, you can see Brett Dorr's studio and some of his work in our video. It's at marketplace.org. The Los Angeles Philharmonic leaves on an 11-day, five-city international tour this weekend. All the usual hotspots, New York, Amsterdam, Paris, London. But the LA Phil is very much not a same-old symphony in both repertoire and style. It's got a reputation as one of the more forward-thinking of the big city orchestras in this country at a time when classical music and orchestras everywhere are trying to keep their footing. Deborah Borda is the woman in charge at the Phil, whose home base is the Walt Disney Concert Hall, about a block and a half, as it happens, from where I'm standing right now. So the other day, we took a quick walk over there to get a tour just as the orchestra was warming up for rehearsal, and then we sat down for a chat.
Wow, this is cool. All right, you know what? It looks smaller from the stage than you'd think.
Okay, so this is center stage, or right at the podium of Walt Disney Concert Hall.
Wow.
It seats 2,232, and when you look around, I bet you can't believe that.
No, it
looks so much more intimate.
Yeah.
And that is the way Frank Gehry designed it. It's called vineyard design, and what that means is the orchestra is literally surrounded by the audience. Which gives it a very visceral impact. Mm. Now, of course, the crowning glory of the hall is right back here. That's the organ. That now has about close to 6,000 individual pipes. The facade, which is so remarkable, was designed by Frank Gehry. The organ was actually built by Manuel Rosales. So Frank nicknamed the organ the French fries.
It
looks a little bit like French fries. I think it's more beautiful than that, but that's the nickname.
Since I have you, something I've always wondered about this organ. Are there actually pipes in all those French fry-y things coming out?
Oh, yeah, sound actually comes through.
Wow.
Yeah. So this is the stage. The orchestra's coming out. We'll go back out this way.
Deborah Borda is a violist by training, hasn't played in many a year, though. Her mark has been made in arts administration, and she's been running the business side of the Phil since 2000. So when we got out of the concert hall and back to her office, that's where we started.
This is, for all of its artistic ambition, this is business, and you are running the business. How much of your time, and you are dependent largely on philanthropy, right? How much of your time do you spend out there hustling, basically?
The Los Angeles Philharmonic has the largest budget of any performing arts organization in the United States.
Give me a number, 200 and something million.
$125 million, okay. Except for the Metropolitan Opera, yeah, which is, of course, bigger, but they have wigs and makeup and elephants and sopranos on the stage. And here's an interesting statistic. Even if we sell out Walt Disney Concert Hall, that covers only 45% of the costs of putting on a concert, because we have enormous fixed cost in terms of paying the orchestra, marketing, operating the hall, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I spend a great deal of time fundraising. That's true. I spend a lot of time also, though, with our board on matters of governance, because the board helps us to raise the money. They are tremendously generous. They give a lot of money as well. But I have to say, you know, I remain very close to the artistic product as well.
There's a question to be asked very specifically of you in your job, and that is the importance of star power. Gustavo Dudamel, certainly, but also this building. What kind of competitive advantage is that for you in a very competitive landscape?
You mean competitive in Los Angeles or in the world?
No, because this is a global enterprise here, right?
It is. This is a global enterprise. Well, first of all, I've come to believe that architecture is destiny. Huh. When you walk in this hall, one cannot help but to think creatively and think differently. It is also one of the representations of the city.
Yep.
When you come into the airport, into LAX, what is the first thing you see? A big picture of Walt Disney Concert Hall. It's just a place that you want to be and where you know you can experience music. So is that an advantage? It's an advantage for Los Angeles, but it's another kind of advantage in that there is no soloist or conductor in the world that doesn't want to appear on the stage of Walt Disney Concert Hall and conduct the Los Angeles Philharmonic.
What about then Dudamel and what he gives you?
Well, Gustavo is a star of the firmament. I mean, I remember when he first came to the Los Angeles Philharmonic, he made his U.S. debut at the Hollywood Bowl, conducting the Philharmonic, and it was just a spontaneous combustion. The orchestra fell in love with him, but so did audiences. And the remarkable, sort of a one-in-a-hundred-year talent was realized by many orchestras throughout the world, and they were pursuing him, and we were too, because we knew we wanted him to be our next music director. And eventually, I actually made a trip to Caracas to spend almost 2 weeks there to see if I could get to know him better in his own country.
So what were you looking for then? I mean, because clearly there has to be some chemistry is kind of wrong, but it's not that far off, right? There's got to be something.
Oh, it's magical in that sense. There has to be chemistry between the conductor and the orchestra. And that simply has to exist. And then in addition to that, these are such immense jobs, the music director jobs at big orchestras, because there are so many decisions to be made about repertoire, about personnel. But Gustavo brought another aspect to us, and that is, as we exist in the 21st century, we have always been so focused on the artistic imperative. Yeah. But what he made us realize, because of his background and El Sistema, is that there is also a social imperative. And so what we search for now is, what is the intersection between the artistic imperative and the social imperative. And that's been a fascinating journey.
You've been here 16 years, plus or minus?
16, exactly.
So in another 16 years, whether you're here or not, what does the LA Phil look like?
Oh, the LA Phil, I think it's in our DNA. I think it's in our DNA, this sense of adventure and this sense of innovation. And what I'm pleased about is I think we have designed a business plan and have enough resources so that I don't have worries that in that many years the orchestra will be here. And what I think at that point is, for example, our Youth Orchestra LA, YOLA programs,
they were in the Super Bowl, right?
They played at the Super Bowl, right. But they're throughout the city. And 15 and 20 years from now, that will be our audience. It will reflect our community even more, as this is such a beautifully vibrant and changing community. That's what I hope for this orchestra.
Deborah Borda, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today. I don't always drink beer, but when I do, I prefer Dos Equis. Actually, neither of those things are true, but there is beer marketing news today. Dos Equis is replacing the actor who played the most interesting man in the world in their ads of the same name that have been running the past 10 years or so. Jonathan Goldsmith is the actor in question. And not that there are any hard feelings or anything, but the last ad he filmed shows him launching on a one-way trip to Mars. So there's that. Also, those ads have been running for 10 years? Seriously? All right, I wish we could keep playing that bridge forever, but hey, we got to go. The Dow up 0.2% today, 36 points. The NASDAQ up 0.5%, 25 points. The S&P 500 also up 0.5%, about 10 points there. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Talladay engineer the program for us. Daisy Palacio picked the music on the program today. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. I kid. Daisy's great.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.